Prepare your ears, humans. Happy, Sad, Confused begins now.
Today on Happy, Sad, Confused, the dark and depraved horror and comedy of filmmaker Ari Aster, director of Midsommar. Hey guys, I'm Josh Horowitz. Welcome to another edition of Happy, Sad, Confused. Yes, new exciting filmmaker Ari Aster is the guest on today's show. If you haven't heard about Ari yet, you presumably heard about his films. He's made two features thus far. Both are excellent. One is currently in theaters, and both demand your attention if you're a cinephile. One was Hereditary. It came out last summer. We had Toni Collette on the show. Tour de force performance from her, and one of the most haunting, visually spectacular debuts in film I've seen in some time. And now he's followed it up with the similarly memorable Midsommar, starring Florence Pugh, Jack Rayner, Will Poulter. This is a crazy movie that you've probably heard your friends talking about if you haven't seen yet. It is definitely well worth your time. I've seen it twice. Yes, twice. I'm that kind of crazy guy. And to reveal a little bit of it, it's basically about a couple who is clearly not meant to last. It's a breakup movie of sorts. They end up going to Sweden for a festival, and the shit hits the fan. Things go badly. Things get really, really bad. It is dark. It is weird. It is bizarre. And yes, it is funny. It's very funny. Ari Aster is a unique new voice in cinema, and I think you're going to enjoy hearing from him today. He's somebody who I think you'll be able to tell from our conversation. We share a lot of sensibilities, a lot of the same reference points, and I couldn't be more interested and optimistic and excited about both the films he's made, but also the films to come in what's sure to be a long and interesting career. So a real pleasure. If you're a cinephile, if you're somebody that's watching kind of like the next wave of great filmmakers, keep up with Ari Aster. He's making some really quality work, and Midsommar is definitely worth your time, currently in theaters. Beyond that, what else to talk about? So much. I'm just back from Los Angeles for another quick little adventure. I think I can say this now because the interviews are done. I covered the new Quentin Tarantino movie, and I've got some really exciting stuff on its way for you guys. I sat down for MTV for an on-camera interview with some guys you might have heard of, Leonardo DiCaprio, Brad Pitt, and Margot Robbie. Yeah, that's kind of cool. That's, even for a jaded cynic like myself, that's a cool day at the office. That's a really, really fun, interesting interview, a rare chance to talk to some folks. You know, Brad and Leo, they don't do that many interviews, so I was very, very honored that they agreed to sit down with me, and I'm really happy with the way it went. I think you're going to really dig it. That comes out next week, just in time for the release of Once Upon a Time in Hollywood. I also sat down with Quentin Tarantino. Yes, I can tease it. He is the guest on next week's Happy, Sad, Confused. And that is a fantastic conversation with one of the smartest big brains in the history of cinema. So well worth your time. Another big, important filmmaker coming at you next week, Quentin Tarantino. So, and by the way, the movie's great. Once Upon a Time in Hollywood, one of the best of the year, will surely be at or near the top of my top 10 list. It is, if you love Tarantino, you're going to dig it. Trust me. Beyond that, headed off to Comic-Con this week. Yes, another year, another adventure in San Diego, where I'll be talking to 1,000 people and trying to stay coherent and upright for a few days as I talk to the casts of all the big movies and TV shows that are visiting Comic-Con this year. It's going to be exhausting and crazy and hopefully a lot of fun for both me and for you guys if you're following along. So all those interviews are going to be up on MTV News' YouTube page and social media accounts. So follow along. If you can't make it out to San Diego, at least follow along with me on my misadventures at Comic-Con another year. That's all the preamble for today. Let's get into the main event. This is Ari Aster, writer and director of Midsommar and Hereditary. Remember to review, rate, and subscribe to Happy, Sad, Confused. Spread the good word. And here is Ari Aster. Ari Aster has entered my office. I was just saying, big fan of your work, a big fan of this new film. And as I understand it, are you sharing a part of your birthday with me today?
Oh, yeah. It is my birthday. Yeah.
I feel like I should have, like, the Midsommar, like, mural behind me of, like a cake-eating Ari Aster, like, just some kind of self-referential birthday horror show for you.
I should have brought it from my house.
Your own collection?
Yeah. I've got plenty of photos of me,
I'm sure,
eating cake just all over my wall.
I'm sure. Well, congratulations on the new film. So there's a lot to talk about. First, I mean, I know from the sequence of events, this has been a much different kind of experience for you than Hereditary, because by the time Hereditary kind of got all the think pieces and all the reception, you were knee deep in this film.
Yeah.
So has this been in some ways more enjoyable? Is this more of the way it you imagined the process of releasing a movie to be?
In some ways, I feel like I'm, I don't know, like chemically incapable of enjoying anything. But
this is why you're welcome here. Yeah. Maybe 45 minutes of self-loathing from two people here, guys. Strap in.
Yeah, exactly. If anything, it's been an opportunity for me to kind of engage more fully with the release of the film and with the reception and get like more defensive and
really
more, there's something about especially making a film because you're relying on so many forces outside of yourself that you can only ever really get so close to whatever you're intending, and so for me every time the feeling that comes up is I just want to go right back and do it again and do it and get closer, even closer. And so
right.
So the release is always kind of, there's something depressing about the release.
Well, it can't live up to whatever's in your brain. I don't even know if there is something in your brain, an idealized version of how this plays out.
The reception?
Yeah.
No, I mean, maybe. It's really more, I guess there's an idea about how people will decipher it.
Because you know, I mean, look, you're self-aware enough to know these first two features are not going to be everyone's cup of tea. They are divisive films. They are provocative films. Yeah. They are
by design. Yeah.
So to think otherwise, to think that it's going to be like Avengers Endgame, is not the right path. But to me, this is the optimal like reception both of these films.
Oh, absolutely. I mean, I feel extremely fortunate.
Yeah.
And of course, like they are by design.
Yeah.
Like polarizing, kind of. They draw a line in the sand and like, you know, plant themselves on one side of it.
Yes.
And I think, I think there's something, there's like the punkish part of me that's like writing that movie and then like directing that movie.
Yep.
And then when it releases, there's like, you don't want to admit it, but there's a part of you that just like, wants like everybody.
Yeah, everybody like me. Yeah. Yeah. Never mind the provocative stuff. Can't you all just team together and just say you love me?
Exactly. But now I'm kind of not gearing up, but I'm deciding what the next project will be. And they're all equally kind of like,
this is what you are.
They are a middle finger. They're all, it's like, which middle finger do I want to present next?
Well, it's funny because like, and we'll get to this, but like, it took me this long to go back to your shorts. Like I hadn't seen your shorts before getting ready for this podcast. And for anybody that thinks like, oh, this is like he's just becoming like a fucked up filmmaker. And he's been doing it from the start. And if anything, those might be more subversive, insane, provocative works. So this is a theme that will run clearly throughout your entire body of work, it would seem safe to say.
Maybe, unless I one day just
make a
grow up
Adam Sandler Grown Ups 3.
Just yeah, I mean, that I would love to make Grown Ups 3. That would be great.
So, when you have to really just pay the bills. Hey, look, I love me some Adam Sandler. So Well, talk to me a little bit about, okay, so you, when you walked in, I asked you, from what I gather, you're a New Yorker now. You actually were born in New York. Mm-hmm. But you didn't come of age here.
Well, no, I didn't come of age. I was here until I was around 7.
Okay.
Then I lived in England for a few years. Okay. And then I guess I came of age in New Mexico, Santa Fe. Spent a long time there. Went, you know, junior high school, and I think like the end of elementary school, and then college.
Do you consider that home? If someone asks you where you're from, do you say New Mexico or do you say New York or England?
I consider myself a New Yorker, yeah. but I think I probably am equally New Mexican. I don't know. When I lived there, I didn't love it because I kind of, I loved the city,
yeah.
and then I liked England, and then all of a sudden I was, you know, in the desert, and it felt like a declension to me. And so
yeah.
I really didn't like New Mexico while I was there. My parents are still there, and whenever I go out there, I like it a lot more. So I think the older I get, the more nostalgic I feel about the place. And I really like Santa Fe now, but when I was growing up there, I was going stir crazy.
It makes sense. I mean, given obviously what you've made your life's work and like where your sensibilities are, like to have like all the trappings of New York torn away from you as a 7-year-old.
I know. Yeah.
For as lovely as I'm sure New Mexico is, it's a different thing. And clearly, I mean, like, are your first memories of going to the movies must be here in New York? Like, were there?
Were here in New York. They're especially in England because that's when I was like really fully, where my obsession was like, you know, it had fully formed by the time I was living in England. And then, you know, and then New Mexico, I was always kind of bemoaning how slow it is there, and. Just like the lack of action, and also I was like a fat kid who had a debilitating stutter.
Got it.
And so I think ultimately it was very good for me as far as my trajectory is concerned because I just stayed at home all the time watching movies and reading books, and then writing screenplays.
Got it.
I guess there are a lot of filmmakers who kind of grew up making Super 8 movies, but I didn't have the confidence to ask anybody to help me make movies. So I ultimately just...
You were writing in your room.
I was just writing scripts in my room and going to like screenwriting conferences from like, you know, from the age of 12 or 13.
So was there a great love of movies in your family? Was there like beyond just every family watches movies, obviously, but was there an inordinate obsession with film outside of you?
Yeah, well, my mom is a poet, and she used to be a visual artist. She is a visual artist. She moved kind of exclusively to poetry recently, or not recently, for the last 20 years. Mm. My dad's a drummer, a jazz drummer. He used to be an R&B drummer. I went to the movies with them a lot. My mom and I are pretty aligned in our tastes. I'm sure my taste was informed to a large degree by hers. It was this thing where, you know, every Friday I would go to the video store and I could rent a couple videos and then we'd like see a movie on Friday. And if the movie wasn't good, like that ruined my week. It's like I wasted my movie.
Was she exposing you to films that were beyond your years a little bit? That seems to be something that often happens for kids, especially people that end up in this industry that really become obsessed with it. They see a David Lynch movie and maybe a couple years too young, et cetera.
Yeah, I mean, that's definitely the case. I mean, some of my favorite films are films that I saw with her pretty young. Like I saw The Piano Teacher in theaters when I was like, must have been 15. Saw the big ones were like Mulholland Drive, Songs from the Second Floor, the ones I saw in theaters, like Dogville. And then there were just a lot of things that I discovered on my own, you know, from a, you know, an early age. And some of them were things that I definitely saw too early. Like I've talked about seeing The Cook, the Thief, His Wife and Her Lover, which like destroyed me. And you know, kind of became obsessed with Martin Scorsese from like the age of like 10 and just like, you know, wanting to be him.
I was going
to
say, was that the first filmmaker that like you went down the rabbit hole and just sort of really dove deep into the filmography?
He was, he was the big one for me. He was, I mean, there were so many when I was young, like, you know, I mean, kind of all the usual suspects when I first wanted to be a filmmaker, and it was, I don't know, Scorsese, the Coen brothers, you know, Hitchcock and, you know, Kubrick and all, you know, all those guys. And then there were, you know, it's just, there's like that, this long circuitous road you take.
Well, one begets five others, right? Yeah, then you hear that like their five influences, and then suddenly you're in, you're in a world of cinema as opposed to the New York filmmakers, et cetera.
And then you disown certain people early on that you like rediscover later. Sure. Like Spielberg is very cool to like kind of hate as a kid. And then you come back to him and you realize, oh, he's actually the best.
Yeah. I feel like I've got, like, gone back and forth on De Palma like five different times in my life.
Yeah. Well, De Palma is a fascinating case because like there are certain things that you can like kind of never embrace about him. And there are certain things that like you can dismiss them, but to your peril, because he is like, you know, who does a set piece better than Brian De Palma?
Right. Yeah. Unfortunately, it was unfortunate because like by the time I started doing this, you know, he's not making the best work of his career in the last 10 years. I'll say that.
No.
And like by the time I was talking to him, and he's always been like an irascible, like tough guy. And you know, and by the time like I interviewed him, it was for like that movie like Redacted, which is not a great movie.
I know.
Like,
yeah.
And it's just like you want, because like, I mean, he's whatever. I could talk endlessly about him. I'm sure you saw the Noah Baumbach doc on him a couple years ago.
I did. Yeah, him amazing. And Jake Paltrow, right?
Yeah,
I mean, and it's just, it's so much fun to listen to him talk. And, you know, I mean, yeah, he's made a lot of weird ones, but what did Pauline Kael say that like about Bonfire of the Vanities, that like it's a terrible movie that only like, you know, the most talented person could have made, you know, that like he makes, like only a genius could have made.
Exactly. I'm literally reading Devil's Candy right now. Have you ever read that book? That's like the making of Bonfire of the Vanities.
Oh, no, I haven't read it.
Oh, you should check. I'm about halfway through it right now. It's a very famous, like Julie Salmon, I think, was the author, who had like unprecedented access, like total access to the production.
Yeah.
And of course, it's infamously one of the most like a huge debacle from start to finish.
Oh my gosh.
It's a good one.
Well, and not long after that, he made Carlito's Way, which is such a great movie.
Such a great movie. So this early stuff you're writing as a teenager, I guess my question is like, you know, you mentioned like your sensibility was very close to your mom's. Like, are your parents and friends and family, when they see your films now, are they like shocked, or are they like, oh yeah, that's Ari. That's what he was into. That's the kind of stuff that he would pursue.
My parents or my family? Well, no, my there's nothing strange about it for my family. Mm-hmm. Like this is the kind of thing I've been doing since I was a kid. Yeah. So they, I think they find it, you know, more or less kind of funny. I mean, I don't know. I mean, I feel like most people who know me and know my sense of humor, it all makes sense.
Yeah. Okay, so jumping ahead, you end up at AFI, which must have been an important experience, the kind of the transition from cinephile to professional.
Right.
So like before that, like I guess bring me up to speed. Like, how did you end up at AFI, and what is AFI? Is AFI the defining experience that really gives you the tools to make this your living?
Yeah, well, for me it was. Because for me, you know, I studied film in undergrad at a school called the College of Santa Fe, which doesn't actually exist anymore. It's been, it's been, it, 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 it physically exists, but it traded names. I don't know what it is.
Yeah, okay.
It's something else now.
It's the Ari Aster Institute for what the fuck happened. I don't know.
Yeah, it was a liberal arts school.
Got it.
Or as I like to call it, a finger painting school. So I spent 4 years learning to finger paint, and then
I went to one of those.
Yeah, and you know, you beg people to help you on the weekends, yes, make your movie, and yeah, and you don't really have a crew, and you're sort of doing everything yourself.
Yep.
Which doesn't actually teach you how to direct.
No.
If anything, it teaches you how to like produce, right?
Right.
And so AFI was great because all the fellows, they call them fellows, are in certain disciplines.
Yeah.
And I was a directing discipline. I was a director there.
Yeah. Do they expose? Is that one of those programs where they expose you to the other aspects, or when you go in as a director, are you like you're there to be a director?
You go in as a director, and you are there to be a director. You have to first AD, you know,
someone else's
two
film,
two yeah, projects for every cycle. It's a 2-year program. The first year you make 3 cycle films, these 3 shorts.
Yeah.
So it's the year has been split up into thirds. And the quality of every cycle film kind of dictates how your work is perceived and who you get to work with, because the people who make the films that, you know, the most people like,
sure,
tend to attract the other people,
sure,
that are the most attractive. Mm-hmm. And that was very useful because, I mean, you make a cycle film, then you play it for the whole school, then you have to sit on a stage as the whole school like just rips you apart. Which is really good. Valuable in a lot of ways. And then you spend the second year making your thesis film.
For you became The Strange Thing About the Johnsons?
That was The Strange Thing About the Johnsons, or as it was originally titled, Like Father, Like Fun.
So for those that don't know, and I'm a latecomer to this too, for a short film, I mean, it's a 30-minute film. It's like, yeah, it's pretty ambitious. The premise is basically a son who is molesting his own dad, who's manipulating and abusing and sexually abusing his own father, right, which obviously a comedy, but it does feel like it almost seems to me like it's a brainstorm session where it's like, okay, let me just think of the most like inconceivable fucked up idea like that, like,
yeah,
you could possibly imagine. Let's see if there's a story there. Is that somewhat close to what you? I mean, like, how much of it was like, I'm gonna be a provocateur and see where it leads me?
I mean, that's pretty much what it was. I you know, AFI is sort of perceived as like the industry school,
right,
and they are preparing you for the industry.
Yes.
And when you first, you know, kind of, when you first come in, they sit you down and they play some of the thesis films that they're the most proud of. And they were all very, very like well-made, solid films, but they all kind of felt like Oscar movies. Like they were just very strategic and like, you know, Triumph of the Human Spirit.
Yes.
Politically correct to like a stifling degree.
Yes.
Which,
if anything, sounds like goaded you to go even further.
Like, it just goaded me, and I was just like, what's the worst thing I could do here?
Right.
And then, you know, I turned that into an exercise to see how compelling and palatable I can make that.
Right.
And so it started as an exercise, and was fun. There was a lot of opposition. But ultimately I did get to make it there. So
to their credit,
to AFI's credit,
yeah,
I was able to make The Strange Thing with the Johnsons, aka Like Father, Like Fun.
Now I'll never be able to think of it in the except in that title. I also watched was it Munchausen? Was fascinating in many respects as well, in that it's clearly a riff off of Pixar shorts, and specifically the famous classic Up montage, which is so beautiful. And it's a really beautifully made film. Like, what you've made is like this like silent montage that is, despite appearances, is also like wholly subversive underneath, and is really about a mom trying to cling to her own son in the worst way possible, I guess. Right. Also has Rachel Brosnahan in it, who you had in a couple of your shorts. How did that collaboration, friendship, whatever, happen?
Well, I first worked with her on Munchausen, and I had cast Liam Aiken, who was friends with her, and so he recommended her, and then pulled her on, and it was a smaller part. But she was so good that then I wanted to write something for her, and I wrote a short called Basically for her.
I saw that one, yeah.
Which we were able to do. We shot that over a day and a half. So there was a day and a half shoot, day and a half long shoot, and then she was in New York the next week on Broadway doing The Big Knife with Bobby Cannavale. Wow. So I haven't worked with her since, but we're good friends, and I'm really excited to see everything she's doing, and she's
inevitable that you're going to do an episode of Marvelous Mrs. Maisel. That's something I would want to see.
Yeah, I mean, they're banging my door down.
Like, you never know. Yeah. So I mean, you know, I think by now, if people are listening, I think they're starting to get a sense of your, the comedic side of your brain, like the subversive side of your brain, which like is funny because when Midsommar started to screen, and as somebody that was clearly engaged in it, you were probably aware of this. Like, there was this debate, like, wait, how much are we supposed to be laughing at this? Right. And I saw it again over the weekend, and like, I don't know, like any film that has like the line, I think I ate one of her pubic hairs, delivered in that way is a comedy in to some respect for me. If you're not getting that, then you're missing something. Were you aware? We talked about this kind of at the start, but I'm curious, like, what was your interpretation of like how people received the film at first in terms of just like how comedic it was or not? Did you care how people, do you care how people interpret it in that way? Do you, what?
I mean, I find it funny, you know, it's interesting to see what people find funny and what people don't find funny. I thought that a lot of Hereditary was funny. It's a little bit more buried, maybe.
Yeah.
Because it is a heavy movie.
Yeah.
But for me, part of the pleasure of that film is absurd stuff being like hanging really like heavy weight onto really absurd things.
Yes.
That you can't even really see just how, you know, zonky it is.
Yeah.
I mean, what happens to Charlie in Hereditary? Like, I find that kind of funny. it's, you know, there's something kind of ridiculous about it, but it's, you know, it's awful.
Well, it's funny and I've seen Hereditary a couple times too, and every time I've watched it, I tend to somehow admit what this says about me. I tend to watch it through like Gabriel Byrne's character's perspective, and it's like that movie should be called like the unluckiest husband and father ever. like I feel so for that guy and what he's going through. That's a tragic comedy right there.
Yeah, I mean, you could say the same thing about Jack Rayner in Midsommar. He's just
right. Except he's kind of an asshole.
He's kind of an asshole, but yeah, he's kind of a dick. But I mean, I think most of us have, you know, been on either side of that line.
Fair.
Of course, we are totally aligned with Florence Pugh's character, so he is, for all intents and purposes, the antagonist and the foil.
Right.
And so the movie is,
yes,
you know, it's all kind of gearing up for a certain kind of catharsis. But
yeah. You've talked about this in terms of let me start with Hereditary, and then we'll get into more Midsommar stuff. So, Hereditary, the first feature, what, like a $10 million budget, something like that? Do I have that?
That was really about six.
Wow. Okay.
Yeah.
So is that a big moment? Like first day on set, like $6 million budget, Toni Collette, Gabriel Byrne, like a really nice cast of people. Although a lot of your crew I noticed was like first features as well. So that's like you got a blend of veterans and newbies. Was there a sense of like, this is what I've been gearing up for, this is where I'm meant to be, or like, holy shit, like I'm not ready for this. What the fuck have I gotten myself into?
Before you're shooting, there's a feeling of like, holy shit, am I ready for this?
Yeah.
And then once you're on set, you just have to like it.
Time's going by so fast. It's all about.
Yeah. It's just, you have to finish your day.
Yes.
And so from the minute you start, it's just a sprint. And so it's no longer something that you can kind of be in your head about.
Right.
I mean, it was amazing because, you know, I kind of held off for a long time. Hereditary was like the 10th script I had written. And then I wrote a couple more after that, you know, because, you know, while I was trying to get Hereditary made, and everything I was writing was just too big to do on a really small, modest budget. And so I didn't know if I was ever going to be able to do one of these movies the right way.
Yeah.
And so, with Hereditary, I was given the resources to do it the right way, which is an amazing gift. And I don't even know how it happened because, who hangs that much money on sort of an unproven...
Right. Well, again, you'll get the shorts and you can see it in those as well.
There were years where I was just thinking, like, what am I doing with these shorts? Like, why am I doing this? Yeah. And then, you know, by the time Hereditary was getting going, I realized, okay, I because they didn't play many festivals, you know,
right.
Two of them played the New York Film Festival, but none of them got into Sundance.
Yeah.
You know? It was, you know, kind of a depressing slog of putting my, you know, putting everything into these short films.
Yeah.
And they're very hard to make because everybody's doing favors. So they're dragging their feet and you're making films out of pocket. And so there was this feeling of like, what is the point? Given that they were, you know, not really going anywhere.
Right.
Johnson's had a weird life online.
Right, the viral life.
Yeah. But by the time we were making Hereditary, it's like, okay, well, so this was a long circuitous road to this, but no regrets.
I've heard you talk about this a little bit in respect to Midsommar, and I'm sure you were on Hereditary as well, but like, how much are you thinking about genre and genre expectations when you're either writing or directing? I mean, like for something like Hereditary, are you thinking in terms of like, I'm making The Exorcist or I'm making Ordinary People? And like, how much are you thinking about like what the audience is thinking when they're sitting in a theater?
Well, Hereditary was an interesting case because I wrote it after I had tried to get a few other features going. Mm. There's one film called Eddington that's set in New Mexico that I still really want to make. Probably not next. But I thought that was going to be my first film. And it was this, you know, kind of ensemble noir, kind of contemporary Western dark comedy.
Okay.
And I spent a long time trying to get that going. And it almost went like three different times. And there were two other features that I was trying to get going. And I finally was like so tired of, you know, not getting there that I began to think strategically, which I had never done before. And
right.
I thought, well, a horror movie would likely be easier to get made. And I love horror, so why not?
And a showcase for like a name actor. Like I'm sure Toni was attracted by that kind of a character. That's probably part of the algorithm too.
Sort of. I mean that occurred to me after I had written it, really. But for me, it was just I like horror movies. Why haven't I written one? And then everything I write is kind of fatalistic and dark and bleak. Yeah.
It's not going to be so hard for me to fit that construct around what I'm interested in.
Exactly. Those things, you know, which are otherwise, you know, kind of a deterrent to financiers and audiences, becomes a virtue in
this
genre.
Yes,
and so Hereditary was, you know, two things. It was an exercise, me wanting to write a horror movie.
Yep.
That I would like. And then it was also extremely personal, and I was putting a lot of my own life and a lot of my own feelings like into that movie. And so it was a matter of, you know, how do I marry these two things in a way that kind of, in a way that honors both.
Yes.
All the way through. And you know, it's funny, Midsommar is the only film I've ever written kind of on commission. You know, I was approached by a Swedish production company
right.
that read Hereditary. They wanted to make a folk horror movie set in Sweden.
Right.
And they came to me saying, we want you to do with Hereditary what, you know, with... We want you to do with this
yes.
what you did with Hereditary.
Yes.
And so I had never kind of taken a job before, and I wasn't really interested in it. I just wanted to like do my thing.
Yes.
But I was going through a breakup at the time, really wanted to write a breakup movie. And as an exercise, I imagined like what would a breakup movie married to a folk horror film look like? And it like opened up the breakup movie for me to the point where I really wanted to write it.
Yeah.
And I actually didn't even want to take the job, but because like the movie kind of formed in my head,
yeah.
I felt like I had to.
Were against the principle of taking the job on assignment,
yeah.
but wait, this is actually opening up a whole world of ideas for me. And
exactly. And luckily they gave me all the freedom in the world and they really allowed me to make my film
There weren't other stipulations like, the antagonist needs to end up inside of a bear at some point.
No, I mean, what I brought to them was I said I want to make a breakup movie that like happens to be a folk horror film.
Yeah.
And it's like in the close of a folk horror film. And I came to them a week later with the entire story, with the prologue and then just everything that happens to each of them, and then the ending. I didn't quite have the bear suit, but I did have, you know, one character sentencing another character to death.
Right.
And I don't want to be too spoilery.
Well, okay. Let me put out the disclaimer now. We're well enough into this that we can talk about some spoilers, I think, for people out there. I will say you've said this is at least inspired by a bad breakup you went through. It must have been a pretty bad breakup. Having seen this film.
Well, it was a painful breakup because it was a long-term relationship ending.
Now, did you give a heads up to the significant other that you were writing this? Like, have they seen this? Are you in touch with them? Or are they?
Well, I really want to respect her privacy.
Sure.
And so like I've been not talking about it at all, but I will say that it didn't just end, like it kind of started up again and like by the time it started up again, like the script was written. and then it did end, you know, after that. So
you're saying there's a chance for a sequel.
It's sort of she's aware. She's aware, but at the same time the characters are not in any way surrogates of she or I. I put a lot of myself into Danny.
Yep.
But it was very important to me that people be able to relate to Christian, even if they don't want to, kind of relate to his situation. But I do, you know, I mean, I wonder, you know.
I love that you mentioned the other day among the influences, it didn't even occur to me, but you mentioned Albert Brooks's Modern Romance as one of them, which I haven't seen in a while, but as you might expect, I'm a huge Albert Brooks fan.
He's my hero. I mean, he's one of my heroes. Defending Your Life is, so I think, the best romantic comedy ever made.
I might agree with you. And I love that, like, I don't know if you noticed, and I think you tweeted about too, but when Rip Torn passed away last week, suddenly everybody came out of the woodwork, and I didn't even realize it was like, oh, everybody appreciates that performance in that film as much as me because I knew Larry Sanders was going to come up, but him in Defending Your Life is just next level,
which is where, I mean, that was pre Larry Sanders, you know?
Yeah. Yeah.
And it's the funniest, like supporting performance in any movie ever. He's so amazing. Rip Torn was just
amazing.
There's nobody like
him. Meryl in that too, and they're all just fantastic.
And then he kind of plays the same character in Larry Sanders.
This is true. Yeah, yeah.
Kind of the most, just like the best sycophant in the world. Yes. Like the most. Like, adorable sycophant in the movies.
I wish I could remember verbatim, but the exchange in Defending Your Life of when Albert is asking him what were you doing, and he keeps saying he wouldn't understand, and he finally says this like non sequitur, like gibberish, and Albert just says, "I don't understand."
Just one of my favorites. And then when he's eating the thing, he's eating. His food. And,
oh yeah, yeah, yeah. And it looks horrible.
People in Judgment City have like the best food in the world. And he's like, you wouldn't like it. And he says, it tastes a little like horse shit, right?
Too good. And now Albert is tweeting at you. You've made it. Mr. Albert Brooks is a close personal friend, apparently, via social media.
Definitely not. But I not for lack of trying.
Do you feel? But in all seriousness, I mean, I've talked to filmmakers that have been talking about your work the last couple of years. Like, I'm sure you've. Have filmmakers reached out to you in email and in meetings or whatever to kind of like, do you feel kind of welcome to a club to some degree?
You know, I think I have the personality where if I were standing in the club wearing the member's jacket,
right.
I would be, you know, waiting to get in. Some people have reached out. And I've made, you know, friends with certain filmmakers in the community, I guess. And it's exciting. I haven't totally processed it. And that's also because Hereditary did come out. And I was, as you said, I was in Hungary on the ground prepping Midsommar. And so I wasn't able to, like, experience that because I was already like in the water and the water's up to my nose and I'm just trying to survive this new film. And so this is the first time I've been able to kind of take anything in. Yeah. But at the same time, we finished this film a week before it was released.
Right. So this is literally the first time to exhale. Like this.
Exactly.
I'm doing press
when I'm not, I haven't made peace with what the movie is because you've just finished it. And anybody who makes films knows that, you don't finish.
No.
You are ejected from the room. And so it takes some time to like come to terms with that. And so I'm starting to come to terms now after I've done all the press,
right.
After I've said all the things I regret saying, cause I didn't have time to think about it. And you know, for me, the thing that I'm starting to get my head around, which is, you know, the dream come true is that I'm making films. I spent 10 years trying so desperately to make films, and I spent my entire adolescence and childhood like dreaming of it and thinking about what that might be. And it looks like I'll have the opportunity to make a third film.
Yes.
And so I'm extremely fortunate and grateful and
on your, you know, budgets withstanding, like on your own terms. Like it seems like, you know, in a certain framework, you can probably make the kind of movie you want, at least the next couple times at bat. Like you've got a couple more times at bat, definitely. And it's probably in this for the long haul. I mean, but as much as you can enjoy this, you should start to enjoy this because it's well deserved. Here's a spoilery, absurd question. Do you own a Will Poulter face mask? Who owns that?
I wish I did. I don't own anything. I don't own any of the miniatures from Hereditary. There are no props. There's nothing.
So where did that go? Where did the Will Poulter approximation of his face go?
And don't forget the necro pants, his skinned penis and legs.
Well, that obviously Will kept.
Those I might be wearing right now.
See, I was gonna say this is his birthday costume.
my birthday suit.
You don't want to go to an Ari Aster birthday party, guys. Trust me.
No, unless you want to leave much lighter.
So we don't know where it is.
I don't know where. I imagine they're in a warehouse somewhere. I I know that that Millie Shapiro has been trying to get her head from Hereditary.
Oh my God.
And some, you know, there are monsters out there who just won't give it to her.
Oh no. Are you worried about running into Alexander Skarsgård, one of the most notable Swedes? He's a New Yorker. He might just punch you, like, if he sees you on the street. Like, how is your standing in Sweden right now, as far as we know?
I mean, I've got my fake mustache for when I leave the house.
Has it been released in Sweden? Is there any?
It has been released in Sweden, and I think so far the reception's been okay. Okay. I mean, Swedes tend to have a pretty good sense of humor about themselves.
Yeah.
There are certainly some Swedes who won't. And yeah, I mean, I wonder what the overall reception is. I'm getting some vague word back that it's doing well there, and that the Swedes find it funny.
I would just be aware if you're invited to like some kind of like special festival there, like under mysterious circumstances, and you get off the plane and suddenly things take a turn. Like, I wouldn't put it past them to, again, you ending up in that bear suit.
I mean, if it happened, I would deserve it, given that I should, of all people,
exactly.
I should be wearing
the last words is, I should have known. I kind of respect this. So of the, you were saying before, I mean, do you have like of the 10 or 12 like scripts in different forms, are there $100 million budget ideas in there? Like how big are the big ideas in there?
There's one sci-fi satire, mm-hmm. sort of an ensemble satire, satire being a very dirty word. I should find another word for it. If I'm
going to get a green light. People love satire. Yeah.
But that
crowd pleaser,
that will be expensive. Yeah. Otherwise they're all bigger than, some.
Okay.
Smaller.
He doesn't want to limit his own budget. He doesn't want to say it's like, I can make them all for $10 million because then they're only going to give you $10 million.
I mean, I made Midsommar for $10 million, and that was so hard.
It was a tough production. Everything I've read sounds like this was about the limit for you.
It was logistically the hardest thing I've ever experienced, and I would like for every movie I make from here on out to be more comfortable than that.
So are you going to be tempted by like IP at all of like are you going to even take meetings with the Marvel, DC, Star Wars? Does the kid in you like want to take that meeting just to like hear out people that, I mean, that's nice to even be thought of in that company.
Yeah. I mean, and I've received some really enticing, cool offers, and I certainly want to hear what the offers are.
Yeah.
I am self-generating. I have so many films I want to make that I've made.
Right.
Or that I've written, rather.
Sure.
That are very vivid in my head, and I just want to, like, put
execute
them out.
Execute it, yeah.
I just want to make them.
But as we know from the Midsommar experience, look, someone has a framework. Maybe it's married with an existing idea. Maybe it ignites some new idea.
Exactly. You know, and that also kind of happened. But that also did happen while I was really struggling to get something made and I needed some money. Mm. But but of course, like, that ended up being something that felt very close to me. And the reason I made it second was not because I owed them that. It grew into something that I felt very close to and I really wanted to make.
Right.
And I felt like I just had it in me, to make next. But I'm starting this production company with Lars Knudsen.
Right. And you're going to do some TV, as I understand it, too?
I'm interested in TV, and I'm excited about supporting projects I believe in. And, you know, I'm especially excited about making movies that shouldn't exist.
Yes.
So, I'm excited about what that will be.
Yeah.
And never say never.
Sure.
Definitely want to look at everything that comes my way. But it'll take a lot to sort of pull me away from these projects that are sort of on the tip of my tongue yeah. that I'm ready to make.
Well, and as a fellow cinephile, I'm sure you're as aware as anybody of to see like filmmakers that you've respected be lured into payday is a horrible term, but like, yeah. but those opportunities, which you can't begrudge anybody to like no. get to play with those tools. But sometimes they can really derail a trajectory for somebody. So I'm sure you're as yeah. cognizant of that as anybody.
But there are, I mean, so many of my favorite films are studio movies.
Well, that, I mean, you see what Nolan went from Memento to working on the largest scale possible, and he's married it. There are ways yeah. to make it work.
No, I mean, absolutely. There are so many examples. I mean, yeah. yes, you can easily point to
yeah.
like disasters and sure. you can point to, you know, like a total flowering right. of potential. So,
and then you look at like, you know, don't let your head explode too much, but like you look at something like the Coens, who I can see you kind of working in that with, in terms of your comedic sensibility, like, and they have pretty much consistently, Hudsucker Proxy notwithstanding, like worked on a similar budget level for 25, 30 years. And it's just like, they're able yeah. to execute brilliant vision after brilliant vision on their own terms.
And I mean, that's hard and I to would argue with, I would never, ever, ever liken myself to them in any way. But I will say that they are for me
the model.
Like yeah. the model, they are for me, like they're the best filmmakers.
Yeah, the most consistently working. Like
yeah,
brilliant. Yeah,
I mean, and yeah, I mean, I really love this like sort of like chaotic design as mm-hmm. of their career as well, where you make No Country for Old Men, yeah. which is perfect, but then you make Burn After Reading, yeah. and then you make what is for me their best film, which is A Serious Man.
See, but, this is you why know, you're, I'm a Jew, always, so. You're welcome here. We have the same reference points as if you haven't been able to tell already. We haven't even talked about Death Becomes Her, which I saw you like cite as your best of the '90s, and that's one of my favorites too.
Death Becomes Her is just so incredible and so funny. It's missing a third act,
right?
But I only want that third act because the first two yeah. are like the just as good as anything I've ever seen.
Yeah.
No, the sequence that's my favorite Zemeckis. Yeah,
I think so too. The sequence with like Bruce Willis and Sidney Pollack as the doctor and the bone protruding out of Meryl Streep's shoulder is one of my favorites in like any film.
it's amazing. Also, just the camera in that movie is like so efficient. So it's such an economical film. It's so funny.
Yep.
That for me is when he kind of peaked just as like as like a master. But I mean, back to the Future, Roger Rabbit,
definitely.
But those are the three for me.
I would say later stages of Zemeckis. I think What Lies Beneath is a pretty great movie too.
What Lies Beneath, I haven't seen it since the theater, yeah. but I loved it then.
Yeah. It's like, yeah, schmaltzy Zemeckis is fine too. That has its place. But yeah, I like his subversive spirit, which has always been there. I mean, you go to like Used Cars and whatever. He's kind of like got that too.
Yeah, and I Want to Hold Your Hand. And,
yeah.
And just to go back to the Coens for one more movie, Hudsucker Proxy.
So
that's like as far as like Hail Marys, like somebody just yes. like they're invited into Hollywood and they're given like the Joel Silver money,
you know, exactly.
just the, like the
literally know. Yeah the Joel Silver movie.
Okay. I mean he's producing, it's not his money, but no, it's but it's being vouched for right by
yes
by it's a Hollywood product, and it is like
that's what they used it for, to make this like
to make this like Preston Sturges, yeah, exactly. like Howard Hawks,
yeah.
Frank Capra, like massive.
Yep.
I mean, it's a masterpiece.
Yeah. When Jennifer Jason Leigh was in here, and as you can imagine, she was one of those things where it's like that's all I wanted to talk about.
Yeah, she's so incredible in that yeah. film.
Well, clearly, hopefully this is the first conversation of many. You're welcome here for every project. I'm putting that down right now. Congratulations on the new one, man.
Thank you.
If people haven't checked it out, check out Midsommar. We only spoiled a few things in there. You can piece it together, but it's really about the ride, as it were, the bizarre, funny at times, disturbing at times, haunting, journey for these characters. It's an exceptional piece of work, and if people haven't seen Hereditary, go back and check that one out too. thanks for stopping by on your birthday, no less.
Oh, no. Thank you for having me.
All right.
Great way to spend my birthday.
All right. We did it.
And so ends another edition of Happy, Sad, Confused. Remember to review, rate, and subscribe to this show on iTunes or wherever you get your podcasts. I'm a big podcast person. I'm Daisy Ridley, and I definitely wasn't pressured to do this by Josh.